Tape 2, Side 2, continuing our interview with Ivan J. Novick.
I think we were just talking about religious education.
Yes.
I mentioned Benny Sepstein, and he said to me in 1978, said that he felt that the direction of all leaders in Jewish life should be paramount in Jewish education. And I think we've seen that as years have gone by, and I think we're making great strides. Just to go back a bit, you know, some people have asked, how did you actually get started in Pittsburgh, in the things that you became involved in? And most unique, I must have been in my early 20s, and I received a call one day from, I don't know if it was either Walter Ellman or Joseph Glick, and they asked me to have lunch with them. And they took me to lunch at Kaufman's 11th floor. And I didn't know either gentleman really at all. And they said they had been identifying individuals in the community who they thought should be part of the leadership program. And they had identified me, and they wanted me to become involved in the Federation, in the Temple. And it was very flattering, and they were two very nice guys. So I accepted, and that was the beginning of the process here in the city of Pittsburgh.
Before we talk about your volunteerism, which is what it amounts to, because it was all voluntary that you did, let's talk about some of your professional, what you did to earn a living. Also, what we didn't mention was when you moved from Hobart Street, did you come to this home?
Yes, we came here, we bought this house in November of 59, and we moved in June of 60 after we done some extensive work in the house. This was always, by coincidence, one of Natalie's favorite houses. And you know how it is when you're looking for homes. We almost bought two or three other homes on streets not far away. And this home became available, and we looked at it. It was way above our price range. And we did make an offer, which was refused. And that was in 1958, actually, November of 58. And the house was owned by a gentleman, Edith and Ruth Oppenheimer. And by coincidence, they used to own the Apollo Steel Company, which was a company that I was involved in at that time. We'll get back to that. in any event, I got a call one day from a friend of mine, Stanley Gumberg, who was doing industrial real estate work for the Oppenheimer family. And he was here, it was a year later. It was November 1959, and on Saturday morning, Stanley called me. We came over, and the house stopped right here at that time. And we put this addition on in 1965. But in 1959, November, we sat here on a Saturday morning about 11, 12 o'clock, and we worked out a transaction that, you know, we were able to acquire the house. And we were very fortunate because there were rather significant higher offers on the house, which the Oppenheimers had refused. But unfortunately, Ed had had a heart attack, and they had built a bungalow on South Lang Avenue. And they wanted to move to the first floor of that house, and they wanted to finally make this sale. So Natalie and I were very fortunate to acquire the house. And that sort of eliminated a middle move. You know, we were able to go to our last house rather young. And we were able to raise the children in this home. This house is a very important part of the Novick life. And thank goodness, mostly good things have happened in this house. Always a few bad ones, of course, but this house really, I think, not only for me and for Natalie and now for Mary, but also for my children and my grandchildren. It's the focal point of our getting together to this very day where we celebrate all the holidays and all the special occasions. On my last special birthday, Mary did something very special. She had a tent over the whole backyard, and it was a very, very special evening. And, hi, honey. Oh, see.
Sorry, go ahead. Do you want to talk?
I'm going to tell you what he said about you, though.
Mm-hmm. Ivan, what about your professional life or your career, what you did as far as business is concerned?
Well, as I said earlier on the tape, my college relationships were very important to not only my social life, but to my business life. A man by the name of Paul Steinlauf here, who had the Lorraine shops in Pittsburgh, and a gentleman named Steve Wolfson from Hartford, Connecticut, who became a physician later. They were very friendly with a gentleman named John Whiteman. And John Whiteman was originally from Gannett. Because of health reasons, he was not able to go into the service. He was a very outstanding man on the University of Pittsburgh campus, was, I think, the first man of the Jewish faith to be on what they call ODK Walk at the university. And John was in the real estate business. And there were two people who were with him at the time, Edward Sitwin, who was an attorney, and Sackanoff family. Anyway, they arranged for me to meet with John, and we hit it off, and I joined the firm, and I began to study for my license.
What was the firm's name?
John Whiteman and Company. Was the name of the company, and I joined John after school, after I graduated college, and Merle and Ed had been with him for about a year, and everybody was struggling a little bit, trying to get their feet on the ground, so I came in, and one morning, I came to the office about 7:30, 8 o'clock, with nobody there, and the phone rang, and I didn't have a license yet, and the phone rang, and the woman identified herself as Mrs. Klein. She lived on Dawson Street, and she said she'd seen an ad in the paper, and she worked early in the morning at the business, which turned out to be Klein's Restaurant, and she said she had to look at the property right away. So I got my car, I went out and I picked her up. It was a Monday morning, and I took her to the house, owned by the Milton, Cy Milton, his wife, on Fernwell Road. And she called her father-in-law to come look at it. She liked it, and by 9:30, I'd made a sale. I didn't have a license. But something had prompted me to bring a short-form agreement with me. I don't know why, but I did. So I go to the office. I get back to the office about 10 o'clock, and we're having a Monday morning sales meeting, and I'm being castigated for coming in so late. In this business, you can't come in at 10 o'clock. Well, I made a sale. That afternoon, Mrs. Milton called and said somebody who wanted to buy that house came by that a couple hours later and were very disappointed. And she said that her friend, Mrs. Lubin, up on Mount Royal Road, was going to sell her house. Maybe I could show these people. Her name was Sam Horwitz, the accountant. So to make a long story short, I go up that night. They wanted price is not important, but we made the sale. I'd win the next morning, and I tell them I just sold another house, and I don't have a license. And so now I got two sales, and phone rings again. It's Mrs. Milton. She says to me, there's another couple that wanted to buy my house. It's not available, but my friend Sarah Gorenz across the street is going to sell her house. Maybe you could show Leroy Sapowitz and his wife show. So I say, okay, so I go out the next afternoon and I show them the house. I give the price, and if you don't want to go on the market, you pay the price. I sold it now. In a day and a half, I sold three houses. I don't have a license. So I came back, and I thought, gee, what a wonderful way to make a living. It was in April of that year. What a wonderful way to be in business. But the next property I sold was not till November. And I sold my cousin Buzzy Greenberg's mother-in-law and his brother-in-law, Dick Robbins, had passed away at the corner of Forbes and Beechwood, and I sold that home to Irwin Wilfer and Florence Wolfe. Mm-hmm. And that was, so I had what they call a dry spell. And then, I'll try to make this a little quicker, and then I had a college roommate, across the hall, named Harold Mortz, who was the assistant to the president of Morris Paper Company, Morris Balder. And Harold was going to go to New Jersey and run the business for himself, and he recommended me to Mr. Balder. So there was a man named Harold Goldstein, who lived on Blenheim Court. He was the guy who ran the company. That's who I went to speak to. Now remember, I had made all this money, in a day and a half, and didn't make any more money until the end of the year. So it wasn't that big a year, so they offered me $100 a week. I thought it was all the money in the world. And I came home, and my mother-in-law said to me, she didn't think it was me, and she didn't think I should accept it. So I told Mr. Goldstein no. And then he called me back in, and he offered me $125 a week. I thought that was wonderful. And the third time, he offered me $150 a week, and I still said no. And then I got a call from Mr. Balder. Mr. Balder called, and he said, called me in to talk to him. He introduced me to his son, Jimmy Balder. And he said, we've heard wonderful things about you. He said, we really want you to become part of this firm. He said, you work with my son. Together, the two of you, work very closely together. And hopefully you become a principal in the firm in the years to come, assuming that everything goes okay. And he says, and to show my sincerity, he said, I'm going to offer you $175 a week, which to me was like, all the money in two worlds at that time. And he said, that's the same that I pay my own son. So I went back, and my mother-in-law said to me, Evan, I don't think it's you. She said, I don't think you would be really happy in such a confined atmosphere. So one of the good things that I did in my lifetime, I listened to her. And so I did not take it. I stayed in the real estate business, and it was very good to me in the years that went by. And then in 1957, unfortunately, John Whiteman became ill and had to leave the business. And in 1957, John and I had a mutual friend named Elwood Jepson, who was a stockbroker who came from Gannett, went to school with John. Through his, as John and I, we became friends. Wonderful gentleman. And one day, I had a mix-up on a lunch appointment. And I'm a firm believer that most of the things that happen to you in life are by accidents most of the time, especially some of the good things. But they happen because you're out there, because you're busy and you're involved. If you're not busy and involved, they don't happen. So I sort of try to keep busy as I can. And I had a mix-up on a lunch appointment. And I went to a lunch where I wasn't supposed to be, and Jepson Elwood was having lunch with Dr. McElree from Greenville, Pennsylvania, and Dr. Keck from Greensboro. And they were talking about a company called Santoy Mining Company, which was a small mining company that was being managed by men that were part of other companies, like the executive vice president of Bethlehem Steel was the president of Santoy Mining, and other officers had, this was like a secondary thing to them. And these gentlemen were large shareholders, and there was a conversation, and they wanted to try to get control of the company, have a proxy fight.
Excuse me, spell the name of the company.
Santoy, capital S-A-N, capital T-O-Y, Mining Company. It was a company that was originally started by Charles Schwab, very well known in the steel business. And this was a company that was a public company, had a listing, on the over-the-counter. It had a lot of money in the bank. For the time, it had income that was, which was sheltered by depreciation because it was in mining. Anyway, I said to Dr. Keck and Dr. McElree that I knew as much about running a proxy fight as I did about medicine. And with that answer, I was in charge of the proxy fight. And we won. It was a main corporation. I was very fortunate to enlist the aid and assistance of Herbert Sachs, who was Charles Sachs' son here in Pittsburgh. He was our attorney. And he brought in a gentleman by the name of Frank Pohl, P-O-H-L, who was part of Burguin, Ruffin, Perry, and Pohl. And we went to work and to try to get control of the company. We ended up winning 50.06% of the vote, and it's called non-cumulative voting. That means that 0.6% could control whoever had over 50%. And we were lucky enough, because the day of the counting of the ballots in Maine, Augusta, Maine, we were losing badly in the first count. And one thing that I did in the previous week, I decided to go to the expense of another mailing. And there was a family from Milwaukee, three ladies who were not married, they were sisters, and they were school teachers, and they were large shareholders. And they came to Pittsburgh to meet me and decided to support management, not me at the time. But when I sent out the other request for proxies, and it's the latest date that counts, you can change your proxy anytime you want in a proxy fight. You can say yes to one side on Monday, and on Tuesday you can change your mind and go to the other side. So our counsel in Maine was a man named Jerry Kendall, who was the head of the Senate in Maine, in the House there, a wonderful gentleman. And when you count ballots, they can go as late as they want in the evening until it's done. But these people were so certain that they were going to be successful that they said, well, we'll finish tomorrow morning, let's go have dinner. And we went to dinner together. I couldn't eat. And then Frank Pohl said to me, I don't care how you do it, but you're going to eat your dinner. So you're not going to show these people, the degree of your anxiety. So, any event, the next morning, we worked all night. The next morning, Jerry Campbell was friendly with the postmaster in Augusta, Maine, because I had requested that the proxies go back to Augusta, Maine. And we go down there at 6 o'clock in the morning, he opened up the post office, and there were all these proxies. People had changed their mind. And the main one that changed their mind were the three ladies from Milwaukee. They gave me the votes that we needed. And their name began with, the last name began with R, and that vote was changed on R. Frank turned to me and he said, "Hello, Mr. President." and that was a major change in my business life, because now I was the head of a public company which has some substance. It had great tax losses, and it was a great vehicle in the marketplace. And I was courted by two groups. One was Maurice Parker, Maurice and Hilda Parker. He had a company called Wilson, and his counsel and accountant was a gentleman, George Sable. And then there was David Lowenthal and Morton Chapman, who had a Apollo Steel, a company called American Bolt Fastener Company, and they were privately held. Wilson was a public company. And both started to woo me to get hold of my asset and, of course, offered me positions with this private company. I would say that the offer that Mr. Parker gave me was, Mr. Sable said he never knew a young man to turn down so much money as I did. And he asked me why I was going the other direction when it wasn't near as good a transaction for me personally. And the answer was that I thought that, no disrespect to Mr. Parker, I just thought that if I made the decision to go with Apollo and we merged our company together, that I would be able to sleep at night. And that was really, and it was again, without any negative aspects to Mr. Parker, because he never did anything I could ever take issue with. As a matter of fact, I sold he and Hilda their home and bought it in Lindhurst Green. But I decided, and what we did, Santori, Apollo Steel, and American Network Fastening merged, and the surviving company was called Apollo Industries. And Dave and I and Mort were a surviving entity, with senior officers. And we began to build the company. We were one of the first groups to do venture capital transactions where we would bring people into the, we would build it. For instance, one of the companies that we put together was Nuclear Materials and Equipment Corporation. It was Zalman Shapiro, Fred Fleischer, and Leonard Petkovitz. And for sake of a better world, we borrowed one of them from Westinghouse and the other two, I think, from General Electric. We built a company around them. And what we did was give them what's called paid-in equity the day the company was formed. They own their stock, they own their position, they don't have to earn it based upon future performance. And that's how NewMex started and became a very successful company, as you know. And we did that with other companies. We did that in the with computer research, which still exists today. We did that with probably four or five other companies, Microstate Electronics, which we put together and around individuals we borrowed from RCA. And we ended up selling these companies to other people, other companies rather. We sold Microstate Electronics to Raytheon. And that was the company that was the originator of what's called miniature tunnel diodes, which changed the whole industry. And it was our little company that developed it. And that's the technology that made Raytheon move above everybody in their field. So we had a certain degree of success. And the steel business was up and down. But the venture capital projects were, went well. But in I was involved in this from 57, 1957. I was involved in the corporate world till about 1964. And as you may recall, my wife Madeline, her mother's sister was Minnie Hyman, Sam Hyman, and our side of the family, my mother-in-law, a great deal of their assets were part of West Bend Realty Company, and Sam asked me in April of 1964 if I would consider coming into West Bend Realty Company, and I declined at that time. And then he asked me again in the summertime, and then finally in November of 1964, he offered me a total partnership with the company, and I was considerably younger than anybody else in the family, and those of you who know Mr. Hyman, Uncle Sam was the kind of gentleman that believed in family being in the business. He thought that was, in our company was only family. There was many people that worked for the company, but in the operations of the company, it was only family. And I joined in November of 64 into West Bend Realty Company. And then we concentrated in the shopping center industry. And when I arrived with the company in November of 64, there were two apartment buildings, the Wyndham and the Moorfield, and there were two shopping centers, the North Hills Village Shopping Center and the Liberty Plaza in North Hills Village in Pittsburgh, and the Liberty Plaza in Youngstown, Ohio. And from there, the rest of the 60s and into the most of the 70s, we continued to build that business. We had ended up with 36 shopping centers of various sizes, that then we became a factor in the profession. And then in the late 70s, the family determined that my second son did not want to come into our business. And Sal's son at that time was not going to come into the business. There seemed to be no continuity. So, and Eleanor really wanted to, I think, retire. And so we decided, I spoke to my friend Stanley Gunberg and suggested maybe he wanted to consider buying, not the properties, but buying the management company. Because our management company was a significant asset. And we did not give up our investments in the properties, but we gave up the management company, sold the management company. We wanted to sell it to someone local who we knew and thought would do a good job, and they have done an excellent job in managing our properties. And they have taken significant positions in the properties also. So it's worked out very, very well for everybody. And we continued to be part of the management for even close to 10 years, about 8 or 9 years, even after we sold the management company. And as I say, it worked out very well. In the meantime, I formed another company, which was called Noble Novick and Associates. And I am still identified as the closest friend I had outside the city of Pittsburgh was somebody by the name of Jim Noble from Akron, Ohio. And Jim and I were co-founders of the Young Leadership Academy of the United Jewish Appeal. And we became very close friends, and our wives became close friends. So Jim, unfortunately, he and Carol, we formed a company called Noble Novick & Associates, and we really did the same things. He was in the real estate business his entire life, and we really did the same things that I did in West Penn. We acquired properties, we built shopping centers primarily, and we syndicated shopping centers. And when Jim and Carol separated, and he moved to Boca Raton, we did the same thing. We headquartered both in Boca and here in Pittsburgh. I was in Pittsburgh, and Jim was in Boca Raton. We just did basically the same thing. And when my son Bill decided to leave, he was with us for about 10 years, but when Bill decided to leave and join IRT Properties, Jim and I joined with some other principals in a company called Oakmont, the Oakmont Group, Oakmont Realty Partners, which is a major, that's our major thrust today. And Oakmont Realty Partners is doing a number of things in the real estate profession. Primarily right now we're doing assisted living projects. We just finished, I was in Norfolk on Friday, and our first two projects are in Hampton, Virginia. We have an assisted living project and an Alzheimer's project, which we just completed. And we have a program to do another 6 in Virginia and others in eastern Pennsylvania. So our major thrust, although we're still involved in what we call retail, commercial retail, shopping centers, apartment buildings, and so forth, a major thrust for our company now is in the assisted living field. And that briefly will bring you up to date.
Very interesting.
Up to you.
No, I think it's been about an hour and a quarter. So that's
would you mind?
It's up to you. You can take it.
So many of the names you mentioned, Ivan, and people
End of tape 2, side 2, to be continued on tape 3.